Webcasting around the world from the desert metropolis of Phoenix, Arizona, this is The Dividing Line. The Apostle Peter commanded Christians to be ready to give a defense for the hope that is within us, yet to give that answer with gentleness and reverence. Our host is Dr. James White, Director of Alpha and Omega Ministries and an elder at the Phoenix Reformed Baptist Church. This is a live program, and we invite your participation. If you'd like to talk with Dr. White, call now at 602-973-4602 or toll-free across the United States. It's 1-877-753-3341. And now, with today's topic, here is James White.
And welcome to The Dividing Line on a Thursday afternoon. We walked in sometime this week, and I think it was Monday, I guess, and discovered that we had massive roof leaks. And in fact, some of the tiles, you know, it's a hanging ceiling here in the office, some of the tiles had actually become so soaked they collapsed and fell in. Thankfully, it didn't fall on my computers, but it takes time to get roofers out to do stuff. And so for some reason, you know, we saw some more storms coming, so we covered everything with tarps and stuff. Well, in the process, somehow, I can tell that I'm sounding very overdriven and overmodulated. And Rich is just sitting there staring at him going, he has absolutely no idea why this is happening. He's staring at the soundboard with this bemused look. Nothing's been touched, but...
Yeah, we're going to have to ride this one out. It's probably a connection that got bumped.
A connection. Why would a connection be overdriving things?
It's not that it's over. Well, it's hooking. It's looping back through something that it shouldn't be looping back through, and I don't know why. And the only way I'll find out is to unplug things and plug them back in.
That's exciting. I guess we probably should have tested all that beforehand. But Rich was busy putting in a new phone system because the phone system died too. Some of you have been calling. In fact, I've never understood this. I've been here later in the evening, and somebody will call, and then it'll just ring and ring and ring because the auto answer thing has died on the old system. And that sounds better. And so some people just let it ring forever. I felt like picking it up and saying, "We're not here!" But that would sort of be self-defeating. Anyway, 877-753-3341, dividing that line on Skype. We had lots of folks that called in on Tuesday while I was doing the Radio Free Geneva with subjects other than the subject I was addressing. So today is your opportunity of catching up with that. I do have something queued up if we work through the calls early on in the program. But I did feel it would be appropriate, and boy, that sounds terrible. I did feel that it would be appropriate. we'll do our best. Address a article that came out yesterday, because I found it absolutely positively fascinating. First of all, Elmer Towns is the only man I've ever seen in a picture who looks like an Elmer, other than Elmer Fudd. Elmer Towns and Elmer Fudd look very much alike, and they both look like Elmers. They really do. It's very strange. He's 77 years old. According to the article that we have here on the newsandadvance.com website, the Lynchburg newspaper, Liberty University co-founder Elmer Towns has been named dean of the school's Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary. Officials announced at opening convocation on Wednesday. Towns, 77, replaces Ergen Kanner, whose contract as seminary dean was not renewed for this year following an LU investigation into claims Kanner made about his upbringing and background as a Muslim. The committee concluded that Kanner has made factual statements that are self-contradictory. Kanner will remain on the faculty teaching online classes, but will not teach in a classroom this semester, Chancellor Jerry Falwell Jr. said in an interview on Wednesday. Towns led the seminary from 1979 to 1992. That's a long time, by the way. 13 years. Also will continue as dean of LU's School of Religion. So they really haven't replaced him if he's already the dean of LU's School of Religion to begin with. Then we have this line, and I asked some folks to look around at all of the major Kanner defenders that are out there to see if anyone had picked up on this, anyone had said a word about it. Notice what it says. The punishment was commensurate with the problem, so we're ready to move on, Towns said about Kanter. I really don't want to talk about him. I want to look toward the future. Now, this is the same man that talked about, theological liberty? Was that the term? What was the term that we used? A theological leverage. Theological leverage, I think, is what it was. And he's the same fellow who initially said, we're not going to do anything about a bunch of bloggers, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm just a little bit confused. Right now, we are having an audio problem. So as much as Rich might want to do so, it would be inappropriate for him to punish the problem. Punish the computer. Punish the soundboard. Punish the connections. You don't punish problems, do you? I mean, if you have a problem, you don't punish somebody about the problem. And so if there... Okay, Rich just got out a big long stick and he's looking at the soundboard. It was a good idea. Okay, you're ruining my illustration here. The punishment was commensurate with the... Now let's do a word association game, shall we? Let's do a word association game. The punishment fits the... And everyone says the same thing. Crime. The punishment was commensurate with the infraction, the crime, the, well, if we're talking theologically, sin. So if Dr. Kanter had a problem, you wouldn't have punished him for it. You would have corrected the problem, fixed the problem, addressed the problem, etc., etc. Instead, we now have the guy who's taking over for Eric Kanter, and he interprets his not being the dean of Liberty Baptist Theological Seminary as a punishment. You know, the one place I didn't look to see if there was any response to this was the one place I should have looked, and that's Norman Geisler's website, since Norman Geisler has taken on the role of he's said Eric Kanter is innocent of all charges, exonerated, everything else. So I wonder if there's going to be any commentary on the fact that the man who co-founded Liberty University and who used to head up the seminary and now is heading it up again has indicated that Eric Kanter is being punished for his problem. I don't understand that kind of language. It's very politically correct, but doesn't make any sense any more than theological leverage did to explain lying. But he goes on from there, and he specifically says, Towns hired Kanter at the School of Religion before he was promoted to dean of seminary in 2005. I saw a keen mind, a great personality. I saw great leadership skills, Towns said. Despite the controversy surrounding how Kanter represented his Muslim background, Towns and Falwell said that Liberty remains a home for Kanter. I think the whole Bible is about God putting people back in the ministry. I see Ergen with a long, profitable ministry, Towns said. Kanter could teach on-campus classes as soon as next semester, Falwell said. Now, once again, what does that language tell you? Does that language tell you that Liberty has viewed what it has done the way that Kanter's defenders have spun it? Whether it be Geisler or Guthrie or Rogers or Lumpkins or whoever else. When you talk about, I think the whole Bible is about God putting people back in the ministry, does that not indicate a removal from ministry? And saying Kanter could teach on-campus class as soon as next semester, why not this semester? Is this a timeout? Is this part of the punishment for the non-actions, the problems, the things he's exonerated for? Once again, the only reason that we ask these questions is, of course, the fact that Liberty has refused to speak openly. A seven-sentence statement is insufficient. And so Liberty did the exact thing that Liberty would need to do to make sure this thing will never, ever go away. They didn't address it openly, and neither is Ergin Canner. So there you go. Elmer Towns in, and Elmer Towns talking about the punishment of Ergin Canner. Interesting stuff. Well, 877-753-3341. We do have a dividing line call. Let me just mention one thing before we go to our dividing line call. Dividing dot line on Skype, a Skype call. This is not the Bible Answer Man broadcast, just so you're wondering. And why I say that is this is an apologetics program, and I do apologetics, and the majority of our calls are on apologetics. But once in a while, and I'm not talking about anybody in specific here. I was going to make this comment before a call that came in earlier today, so don't feel badly. To the brother who knows who I'm talking about. Sometimes I can't tell from what's on the screen or from, you know, what the person has said, where they're going to be going. And I am very uncomfortable with some of the topics that come up because they're not about apologetics. They're much more general. And sometimes, let me put it this way, I never want to have my name dragged unnecessarily into a discussion taking place within churches, for example, within a church. I've had people call up and say, well, my pastor is saying this. Well, if your pastor is saying that, and I realize there are some contexts in which this is appropriate, for example, a person who's come to understand the doctrines of grace and they're just getting, you know, they're being accused of heresy and all the rest of that stuff. Okay, I understand that. But sometimes some of the questions I'm asked just really shouldn't even be being asked in public, to be honest with you. And sometimes some calls are, they concern me because they could be construed as taking stuff that should be within the local church and dragging it out into another arena. And the last thing I ever want to have done is to be dragged into that situation. And I think that would be sort of a misuse of the program. So when you call, and I'm encouraging you to call at 877-753-3341, try to give Rich a real good understanding of where you're coming from, and We want to do apologetics here. We want to make it something that's going to be, usable to the widest audience possible who are listening, and I think that's important. So, I in other words, we generally also don't do a lot of eschatology questions, and we just had someone suggest in channel that we have a program on crop circles, that's definitely something that you can call somebody else with. In fact, what's that called? Coast to Coast? Is that what it's called? The Wacko program at night? Those would be the people to call about crop circles, because personally, I think people listening to that program are the ones making the crop circles. That's Oh, goodness. All right, let's take our phone caller, and then I have an interesting thing queued up that I think a lot of you are going to find very, very interesting. But let's go ahead and talk to Andrew. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, Dr. White. How are you?
How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you.
I understand you're calling from Estonia?
That's correct, yes, from Estonia to Arizona.
That's a bit of a – what time is it there?
It's quarter past 2 a.m.
2 a.m.?
Yeah.
I see.
I got my time zones muddled up. I actually called an hour earlier, but
you don't sound
anyway,
it doesn't sound Estonian. You sound a little bit British to me.
That's funny. Yeah, I'm a Brit living here basically. So
did you notice how easily I picked up, you know, the British accent like that? You know,
that's amazing. I don't know if it's speaking with Hitchens or listening to Hitchens.
No. It's being on Justin Brierley's Unbelievable Radio program.
That's it, yeah. Ah. Yeah, I did hear that. Okay, well, I've been rumbled already. I think Rich probably gave you a a byline of Islam.
Yes.
I'm somebody who I'm a new Christian. And I was some time ago. I was on the cusp of taking the Shahada.
Really?
I was, and I didn't. I'm happy to say. And I, coming across your YouTube channel was fantastic for me, because I'd already, you know, I'd come to the conclusion, some of the conclusions that you point towards, but by no means all of them, because I'm new to this. I mean, mm-hmm. like most of my intro to Christianity really was through C.S. Lewis. And his books, and I mean what I'd I didn't have much of an understanding of the doctrine of the, and still don't, of the doctrine of the Trinity, for example. But listening to the so-called top Islamic apologists, some of whom you've posted excellent responses to on your channel. I could see that they skated over things with such, take for example the atonement. I don't have much of an understanding about that, but I had more than enough to know when they were just skating over things and kind of mm-hmm. just saying, oh, well, that's not fair. Somebody else paying for your right. your sins. How does that work? And I mean, you know, that's like saying, I have friends in debt and in financial problems, and I dig him out of that. Nobody's going to say that that's not fair. I came across the Dean Show, which I know you've definitely come across.
I'd love to be on the Dean Show.
I'd love it if you were on the Dean Show.
I would jump at the opportunity. You bet.
I mean, I can't see it happening.
really?
Really, yeah. Yeah, sticking my neck out.
yeah.
So we have the next nearest thing with your posts.
Right. Oh, I wish I had more time to do that. Because
that's great. I wish you did. Yeah, it's fantastic.
Yeah. I want to get back into that, and I'm putting a block on travel next year, at least portions
right.
of next year, to hopefully be able to do some of that.
Great. I mean, it's kind of, maybe it's a bit selfish, and I have to watch for, now I'm having to watch for kind of a little bit of gloating that's coming in there sometime.
Well, let me ask you a question now.
Yeah, go ahead.
If I could. Now, you said you're a new Christian.
That's correct. Yeah.
So how new are you talking about?
Well, look, this is where we're in agreement about Islam. We might have some differences here. I'm only hazarding, but I'm Orthodox, actually.
Okay, all right.
I was chrismated literally about 2 months ago.
Fairly popular in Estonia.
No, it's not. Estonia's the numerically the obviously they were part of the Soviet Union, so
right.
they were all the churches were.
But they do have a presence there, right?
Yes. I mean, right. the Lutheran Church is bigger.
Really?
Yeah.
I was unaware of that. Interesting.
Yeah, it was a German. They were a German colony for a long time, and that's where that came from.
Well, I just learned something new.
Absolutely, yeah. And Orthodoxy kind of neighbors of Russia, so it kind of spread that way, and they some of the old believers, historically, some of the Russian old believers actually took refuge in Estonia, and they went and lived there.
That's interesting, maybe, because one of the things that at least some people have said is that at least in Orthodoxy there is a very strong emphasis upon the Trinity, and yet what would be attractive to someone who had recently joined the Orthodox Church about Islam? What was attractive?
I think that. Wow.
Well, I didn't mean to put you on the spot. I just since you said you were looking at that direction and then and found that information and that helped. It's just I think it's to me it's interesting to know what is attractive to a non. I mean, your background obviously isn't one of you know that would be filled with Islam or anything like that.
No, no.
What attracts Westerners? You would account as a Westerner. What attracts Westerners to Islam?
I think that there's all kinds of reasons. I mean, there must be psychological reasons, and there's a kind of convert psychology, which I think you've mentioned before. But that there are many different reasons. I think for Westerners in general, for some people, it might, without you know, disrespecting, trying not to disrespect anyone, it might be an act of rebellion sometimes. It might be an attraction to something which is very, very different from what they've been brought up with. Obviously, a strong image, which is picked up.
Were there certain individuals in your life that were?
No, not at all.
Really?
Apart from these guys on the Dean Show, I suppose. But
really? Interesting.
I kind of, so it runs the gamut on the Dean Show. They've got some very, some very eloquent speakers.
Right.
Nooman Ali Khan. I don't know if you've seen any of his. He tends not to engage in apologetics as such, but.
That's interesting because Yasser Khadi is similar along that same line. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. There are different people, and then there are the people who you can just see through, even if you don't have much of a very strong Christian background or any other.
But then you've got folks like Yusuf Estes that are on it all the time. Was it searching for the Dean Show on YouTube that brought you over to mine? Because I maybe put that in some of the search parameters or what?
Well, I'd kind of decided, not to take the Shahada because I hadn't studied it enough, and I had picked up on some things already, as I mentioned, and they seem to just skate over. You know, they attack Christianity a lot, but they did it in a way which even I could see was just very, very superficial.
Mm-hmm.
And something didn't ring true in that respect. There were kind of, there were these kind of cultural things as well. And, you kind of thinking, well, I really have to, it's almost like I have to,
come up with a Muslim name.
Come up with a Muslim name. well, that would be easy enough. But
the range is not overly wide. But
I'd have to sort of in a way divorce practically everybody I know as well. Which, if you believe that's the truth, then that's the way you must go. Of course,
right. And I
just something didn't ring true, and I read more about it, and the literature seemed to be very, very. Very just not very compelling and quite one dimensional
so what did bring you over to my videos then?
I was in the process of being a catechumen in the Orthodox Church, and I guess I did go back and view a Dean Show clip, and it must have been the Yusuf Estes one, because that's the first time I saw you was the Yusuf Estes the set of when he was trying to deny the Trinity,
right.
and just watching that, I thought, wow, that there's so much there that I just had just passed me by. I think I had definitely seen that show before,
right?
And you kind of when you were, you're a kind of neophyte, you think, well, this is somebody who, as they say, he was a former Christian, says, and he must know more about it than I do, and seems to speak with authority. I mean, I can see he's an entertainer, in essence. He's an entertainer, he's got a good rap, and a lot of people are going to, sadly, a lot of people are going to to fall for that.
Oh yeah.
Really.
Oh no, no question about it. No question about it. That's very, very true. Well, so you haven't seen the book, The Forgotten Trinity, then?
Is that the Airman? No, that's not the Airman.
No, that's my book.
Your book.
On the Trinity. We'll have to try to get that to you, because you indicated, well, you know, not. And did you see the? Have you found my blog yet?
I have, yes.
Okay, so did you see any of the programs that I did on ABN, specifically on the crucifixion and the atonement?
I haven't yet, so that's
yeah.
Just on the list.
I did a. ABN has those up both on YouTube and on their website, and eventually. A 16 part series on answering Islam will be aired on ABN as well. So we'll obviously be putting those up as they become available. So we'll go into a whole lot more depth at that point than we do on the live shows. But yeah, that information's there too. So well, that's very encouraging. I really, really appreciate hearing from you, Andrew. And
just on the question of orthodoxy. I know you've debated Catholic apologists a lot. Where some of your views on that, but do you have any? I mean, it would be interesting for me, obviously, if you ever debated an orthodox.
No, I've avoided getting involved in it. I mean, I dialogued a while back. In fact, the local Salem radio station won't have me on anymore because. They had two Orthodox guys fill in for the drive time guy, and they were attacking Sola Scriptura, and I called in, and we ended up doing a 45-minute discussion, and now I never get to be on that program anymore. But anyway, a number of reasons. Real Orthodoxy involves such a different mindset than people have in the West. It takes a long time to explain to people what is involved with it, and the mindset, the idea of not having whatever you just did, Rich. It sounded like it made a big change. The idea that you don't have a systematic theology you go to and say, okay, we believe this, this, and this, that the liturgy of the church and the prayers of the church are the primary source of the theology. The fact that the Eastern Church does not think in the forensic legal way that the West does. It takes so much time just to explain that. I've really felt that there have to be other people that would be up for the task, and so I have, despite the fact that a number of Orthodox folks have chased after me, trying to goad me into doing things, I have avoided the temptation because there's only so many things you can do and do well. But obviously, to me, the primary issue is once again one of authority and the sources of authority. And I think most of what I say on a theological level in regards to Sola Scriptura would be just as relevant to at least the attacks on Sola Scriptura that I've read from westernized Eastern Orthodox folks. I'm not sure exactly what form that necessarily takes from Eastern Orthodox folks that are actually thinking in an Eastern way. But so that's the other problem, is that I've even had some Orthodox folks say that they don't really even look at people like Frankie Schaefer when he was still pushing the Orthodox perspective as really being Eastern Orthodox, because they're still thinking as Westerners. And so you have that issue as well. So there's all sorts of things that come up along those lines. But obviously, to me, the issue would be the source of authority and whether there can be reformation if you keep establishing the liturgical practices of past centuries as the final authority in all things. So there are some good works out there on the subject, but they're few and far between. And so that's where we're coming from.
Okay.
All righty.
Well, that's fantastic.
I mean, obviously for me, I'm concerned that there's a lot of nominalism in Eastern Orthodoxy because it's very cultural, and And there's a lot of conflict between Russian Orthodox and Greek Orthodox
yep.
and politics and stuff like that. And there are a lot of people in those churches that are in those churches just because they've always been in those churches.
Well, that's a fair criticism, yeah.
I'm concerned that that leads to a form of, you know, to formalism and nominalism and there needs to there are issues in regards to, for example, the nature of sin that I would want to really address with Eastern Orthodox folks and the concept of justification and stuff like that.
Right.
So, but I confess, it would take a fair amount of review and study of new material to address that subject in a meaningful fashion. And I'm just not one of those folks that thinks that any one of us can do everything in that
sure.
way. You know, there's only so many things you can do well. So, alrighty.
Great. Well, thank you very much.
Okay. And, thank you, Andrew. It's great to hear from you. I'm glad to know that YouTube is viewable in Estonia.
yeah. We've got electricity and everything.
Electricity and internet, obviously, since had you on for quite a while now.
No roof leaks.
well, yeah, we've got them here. So I guess you're.
I didn't think you ever had rain there. But
believe me, when it comes, it comes in buckets.
Right.
That's what
right.
happened.
Okay.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Andrew. Thanks for calling. Keep listening.
Thank you. Thanks.
All right. God bless. Bye bye.
Will do.
Thank you. 877-753-3341. I think that's our first Skype call from Estonia, to be certain. I'm sorry? Oh, sure. Yeah, it's first contact we've had from Estonia. But certainly, I just, you know, I mean, if I had broken into my English accent, no one could have told the difference between the two of us. So that's why I didn't, so that we could all... understand. Let's go to our phone lines at 877-753-3341 and let's talk with Jonathan. Hi, Jonathan. Oh, you know what? I got to do that on my end. I'm sitting here expecting somebody else to do it, and Rich is going, what are you doing? Hi, Jonathan.
How you doing, sir?
Doing pretty good.
I am, I was going to use Skype, but I have a baby upstairs, so I wanted to go ahead and retreat to the landline. but I wanted to, I guess, let you know who I am. I've been in the chat room a couple times. I am a gentleman who worked with Ken Hovind for many years, attended Peter Ruckman's church, almost enrolled in his school, built Gail Ricklinger's website, and lived with Ruckmanites for many years as well.
Well, I'm not really certain that the building of Gail Ricklinger's website is something you want to necessarily, you know, publicly
reason I even mention that is because I'm no longer a King James onlyist, and so it's kind of funny to know that it was... you know, through my hands that she's able to propagate her material online.
Have you ever heard the story that when I was writing the King James Only controversy, as I was writing the chapters where I was dealing with her, what I would do is I would write a section and then I would fax it to her for her comments because I'd put a little cover letter. I want to make sure this is accurate. If you have any corrections, if you have any, you know. And I think the second time I tried to send something to her, after the cover letter started, the line hung up. And every time I'd try to fax it, the other line would just simply hang up. And so I mean, she three times sent letters to Bethany House Publishers threatening to sue them if we published the book, which is what delayed it as long as it was delayed, in fact. But I bent over backwards to try to do that. But that's back in the days before. I mean, that was 1994, and so.
Well, I know that in 2006 you had tried to make a purchase on her website.
Yeah.
And they refused to fill your order.
Yeah, I stumbled across the image of the email rejection that was sent. We do not fill orders for James White.
I thought that was just adorable.
Yes, that's great. So you aren't in that group anymore. Having been in that group, when you leave it, you generally don't get treated quite the same way as you used to be treated.
No, I've got quite a few friends online. I mean, to make matters worse, I'm also reformed today, so now I'm a dirty infidel Calvinist as well. but I do have quite a few King James only friends on Facebook, and so I do, on a regular basis, get called an infidel or a heretic or a Bible rejector, or even last week was a tool of Satan.
Ah, well, you know so, what? Yeah, believe me, you've not walked in my shoes yet.
No, but I'm looking at that path with
yes,
great
indeed.
Excitement.
Yes,
so, the reason I'm calling today, though, I'm constantly looking for new things to discuss with my King James only friends. And one thing I've been hearing a lot lately, listening to your interactions with Muslims, especially in your recent discussion with Ehtisham, I'm glad that you stopped hiding that from everyone, so we could all see that. They constantly make reference to the way in which the Quran was preserved,
right,
and that there are no variants. It was delivered in Arabic, and it exists today in Arabic. And I look at that, and it seems as though they view the Quran, the issue of preservation, much like the King James onlyists do, the King James Bible, as opposed to, I mean, obviously, they won't argue that it was handed down in English, right, except for maybe a few would say that Paul carried around a King James Bible. But am I being naive or wrong in kind of comparing the two perspectives of preservation?
No, let me just mention one thing. I was going to blog it, but I'm way behind in my preparations for this weekend, so I just haven't gotten around to it. Hopefully next week I will. But I just listened on Tuesday to a debate that actually took place a year ago. I've had it for a year, and I just didn't get around to it, and I was reminded to do so. Excellent debate between Nabil Qureshi and Bassam Zawadi on the perfect preservation of the Quran that took place in 2009 and in London. And I'm hoping, really, really hoping, to debate Bassam at least twice, I hope, in London next year in February. We need to start letting people know about that, because I'm not going to get there if we can't get enough people to help me get there. But anyway, it was an excellent debate, and I really think that Bassam Zawadi is doing everything in his power to put himself into the top tier of Islamic apologists. After watching Ehtisham Ghulam, if you listen to Bassam Zawadi, you're going to go, wait a minute, those guys are not in the same religion. Bassam actually is attempting, and I'm going to encourage him to continue to do this, attempting to strive for consistency, and he certainly does a great deal of research, and he doesn't just simply throw out everything in the kitchen sink. He tries to make his arguments consistent, which is really is what's setting him apart from a lot of folks at that point. So it was an excellent debate. Nabil was well prepared. Bassam was well prepared. So I just want to mention that's not the normative Islamic approach to the subject of the preservation of the Quran. The average Muslim, when I was standing in Leicester Square in London, one of the most beautiful places I've ever been on the earth, talking with a whole group of Muslims, there is absolutely no question whatsoever that the mindset that they have in regards to their sacred text is identical to the mindset when it comes to unwillingness to examine other viewpoints, unwillingness to examine its own viewpoint for consistency, dogmatism. It's identical to the Rachmanites. I mean, there just isn't any difference, because from their perspective, if there's any variation at all, then you don't have the Word of God at all.
So would you? I know that they're slightly different, the history of the Quran as opposed to the history of the Christian canon.
Oh, sure, a huge difference.
Would you say that if you were to take, while both positions are wrong, would you say the Muslims at least have a stronger argument because of their history as opposed to the King James onlyists?
Well, the difference is really, there isn't a comparison as far as the history goes, to be honest with you, because with one, you're talking about an English translation, 1,600 years down the road, and with the other, you're talking about a concept of basically a revision under Uthman that perfectly accurately represents. Now, I mentioned Bassam admits that there are different readings, and he explains these under the topic of the Aruf. It's too much to go into right now, but he recognizes that there are textual variants. He did not dispute, for example, when Nabil showed Surah 2, 222, the graphics that I've produced showing the editing of that text between the Fogg's Palimpsest manuscript and the modern Uthmanic text, he did not dispute that. What he basically said was those are inspired variations, which, as you are familiar with Peter Ruckman, actually sounds a little bit similar to some of the things that he has said. So it's more the mindset, not the history. The history is really not, can't be connected, because you're talking about a government-controlled transmission of a text in the original language in comparison to a translation that is done in another language that didn't exist when the original was written. So there's a huge difference between the two. It's the mindset, however, that says, look, we have to absolutely have a black and white, no questions asked, not even the questions that come up in the standard translational process. You have to, I mean, you've heard the recommended question. Look, if you believe that all these translations accurately represent what's, then what, where's the inspired word of God? And that's exactly what the Muslim is thinking when they're holding their Arabic Quran, even if they can't read the Arabic Quran. The idea is, here it is, no questions, no gray areas. I don't want to hear about Fogg's Palimpsest manuscript. I don't want to hear about Ibn Masud. I don't want to hear about Ubay ibn Ka'b. I don't want to hear about whether there were 111 surahs or 114 surahs or 116 surahs. I want absolute certainty, and then I'm going to behave on the basis of that absolute certainty. And now, thankfully, with the Rechamanites, that normally just means that they can be extremely nasty. I mean, I could go get Pete Ruckman's book that he sent to me called Black is Beautiful.
And, yeah, I've heard that.
Yeah, that has written inside, here's further evidence of my heresy, Jimmy Boy, written in his own hand, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so I've certainly experienced the nastiness that can result from that kind of a mindset. The scary thing is the nastiness that results from the Islamic mindset can result in things like 9/11, where you are so absolutely certain of this revelation that, you know, as long as someone pretends that they are presenting it accurately to you, you're willing to, you know, fly an airplane into a large building. So a little bit of a difference on that end too. But the mindset of no gray areas, God has to do it the way that I think he had to do it. Yeah, it's identical. There is, and I've pointed that out to people from both perspectives before.
The reason why it at least struck me as valid that the Muslim has a better argument is because there are more, and please correct me if I'm wrong here, I may be just giving us a superficial gloss and leading myself into error, but there are more extant manuscripts of the canon text than there are of versions of the Quran down throughout history. So we have more physical manuscripts containing variants than they would.
Two things. Remember, the Quran is significantly younger than the New Testament, and hence the time period when it is transmitted by hand is significantly shorter in comparison to its entire lifespan as that of the New Testament. So that's the first thing, is that it didn't have to go through as much handwritten transmission. But the most important difference between the two is not so much the script or the means of doing it, but for the first 300 years of the a little less than 300 years, of the transmission of the text of the New Testament, Christianity is a persecuted religion, and it is illegal to own these documents. And so you have a massive but uncontrolled widespread distribution of this text, but you also have massive destruction of the text under the persecution of the Roman Empire, which results in the fragmentation of the transmission lines that we have in the New Testament. You compare that with the governmentally controlled revisionary nature of the promulgation of the Uthmanic text, where you have the powerful caliphate as it grows, as it has, you know, this military power behind it, and it's that caliphate that is in control of the official version and is seeking to enforce that official version even over against competing versions such as the Ibn Masud transmission line and the people who live in Kufi who were also followers of the prophet, but they didn't really like Uthman. So there's a major difference at that point in the first many centuries of the transmission. There still are those variants which demonstrate those other readings were there, but in comparison to the evidence we have for the New Testament, yeah, major difference. And of course, if there is any major historical foundation to what Uthman did in the destruction of the preceding codices, as we read in Sahih al-Bukhari 6509-510, then that introduces a whole major area. If we don't have a Christian Uthman, there was nobody in those early centuries that could go around, despite Jack Chick's pictures of Roman Catholic monks, sneaking around the dark. There was nobody who could go around and try to enforce a particular version, destroy codices and things like that. The Christians were hiding from the Romans, for crying out loud. There was no way they had that kind of control. So we didn't have a Christian Uthman. And so the difference in those first 300 years is stark along those lines.
Okay. Well, that's kind of what I was getting to. Was I know what you had mentioned in your, I think you had mentioned this referring to your debate with Bart Ehrman, that a King James only is of the most strict type, because I would still consider myself a King James only is, according to your book, The King James Only Controversy, and that I still read it predominantly as my primary translation.
Mm-hmm.
But I do consult the NASB practically daily.
You're not a King James onlyist if you use any other translation, really.
Well, you have several different categories that you lay out.
King James preferred and things like that. But King James onlyist, I thought anyways, I'd have to look at it, but I thought I differentiated between someone who would prefer the King James or use the King James. And those who would say no, it is the only translation that God would have you to use.
No, you did. You did quite well. I'm actually on my second time through the book. But what I was thinking was, if you were to take a King James onlyist and a Muslim who is educated on the history, to some degree, of the transmission of the Quran,
mm-hmm.
and you would sit them face to face, the Muslim would have a far better argument using their using both of these guys' perspective of how the text ought to be preserved,
right.
The Muslim would have a far better argument for the supremacy of the Quran over the King James Bible.
Well,
is that accurate?
I suppose. I mean, what did surprise me in listening to the Bassam Zawadi debate was it did come down to a theological presupposition for him as well. That is, he accepts a certain reading of the Hadith literature where basically Muhammad says, well, Gabriel gave it in seven different ways, and as long as you use one of those seven, you're good. And that's a theological presupposition that is sort of similar to what the King James Onlyist is saying, and that is, well, God wanted to give us the purified text, and there was a special, something special happened between 1604 and 1611, and you can always assert some kind of divine inspirational or providential activity, I suppose, that will explain your particular text. But at least historically, it would seem to me that given that the locus of the preservation period for the Muslim is in the first 300 years of the transmission of the text over against, in essence, a re-inspiration of the text in the 17th century in a non-original language, that, the Muslim would have a much better, direction to go there, argument to go there than the King James Onlyist would.
I appreciate your insight on that, because that's kind of the way it struck me. And I was speaking with a King James Onlyist friend of mine and 3 days ago, as a matter of fact, and I just mentioned in passing Desiderius Erasmus, and he had never even heard of the name. And I think if he had, and he knew what went into the TR and how it was constructed, and that there were various versions of it, and the King James came from the third, it would completely destroy any reliance in the King James on a position that he had using his idea of preservation, because he would have to concede. I think you guys even went through this with your debate with Tex Mars on the John Hinkeberg show, that by that reasoning, there is no word of God up until the 17th century.
Right.
And that kind of destroys any reliance in God faithfully keeping his word,
The guys on the Ankerberg show, they never really wanted to engage the subject, though. They didn't really want to answer the question. Well, that's because they actually took two different perspectives. Joe Chambers wasn't taking the same perspective as the fellows representing DAOH's perspective. And so they answered that question differently from one another. But anyways, hey, we got one more call we want to try to sneak in. So, Jonathan, thank you very much for your phone call. And very interesting to get a chance to two very interesting phone calls so far. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Thank you. God bless. Bye-bye. That was interesting. I wonder, he could tell some interesting stories, I'm sure. But let's try to sneak one more in here. Let's talk with Joe in Huntsville. Hi, Joe.
Hello, Dr. White. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
And I don't know if this is going to be as interesting as the other ones, but I'll give it a shot.
You haven't designed any websites for famous King James Only folks?
No.
Oh, and you're not calling from Estonia?
I am not.
No, in fact, Huntsville, Alabama. Huntsville, Alabama, Estonia. About the same. Very similar.
I tell you what, there's plenty of King James Onlyists in this area.
Oh,
I feel
yeah,
like I'm at the
are.
Hub. And I come against that quite often. My neighbor is a Primitive Baptist pastor. And let's put it this way, we are pretty much civil right now, but things have gotten pretty nasty in the past, but I try to keep it, you know, on the high ground.
But, it's difficult. But anyways, yes, sir.
Anyway, this question was regarding your discussion on the Unbelievable program about you had talked about hell, and you said if men, reprobate men, could get out of hell and had a chance to go to heaven, that they would walk right away from heaven and away from God and walk right back into hell. And I guess my question is, I've always understood when men are put in hell by God and there's weeping and gnashing of teeth, I was assuming that that meant that men were both regretful, sad, and angry, and that they would not want God, first of all, but they would not want to be under punishment either. Is that, am I missing something in that, in fallen men?
Well, certainly I would imagine that every person 10,000 years into eternity, if that's even a meaningful way of saying things. I mean, I'm obviously using a time frame there, which we don't know the nature of time. But anyway, my assumption would be is if they had the opportunity to stop being punished, to again satisfy their own lusts and desires. Certainly, I think they would do so. But my point was that if they were given only one choice, which was not focused upon stopping being punished, but the choice was to either worship God and love him with their whole heart, or go back to their place of punishment, that they would go back to their place of punishment because their hatred of God, when that restraint that is upon the evil heart of man is removed, which I think is part and parcel of what hell is all about, that it's insane. And it's a form of insanity. And so they would revel in their rebellion. They would never submit voluntarily. They would never present a heart of love to Christ. So it really wasn't focused on the idea of punishment. It was focused on if you only have these two choices.
Gotcha.
That smoking soul is going to get back up and march right back into where he was. One of the things that didn't really come out in that I just mentioned just passing was I think part of the weeping and gnashing of teeth is not repentance. Those are not tears of repentance or sorrow or seeking of forgiveness or anything like that. I think one of the problems is we have this idea of hell as this bright place where people, you know, people say, well, see you in hell and stuff like that. I don't think you'll see anybody in hell. I think it is a place of, it's called outer darkness.
Yeah.
And I think one of the greatest punishments of hell is the inability to satisfy one's lusts and desires, including the overriding desire to express hatred toward God and do anything that would cause damage to God, maybe in the persecution of his people or anything like that. But I think that inability to satisfy one's lusts and desires, now that those lusts and desires are completely out of control, is also part of the punishment of hell. I don't think God has to extend any effort to punish anyone in hell. I think when you take the soul that is opposed to God and remove God's restraints from that soul, the punishment becomes it just happens naturally.
So you think the lust will actually be felt in an increasing measure because God kind of like gives them over completely to
you
what
know,
they are?
Doesn't that make sense? I mean, if the whole thing of Romans 1 is he gives them over. And yet there is some level of restraint in this life, then certainly there's no restraint left whatsoever there.
And
scary. Yet I don't think that there will be any mechanism for the satisfaction of any of those lusts, whether it be for power or sexually or food or anything like that. And so I think the weeping and gnashing of teeth needs to be understood in that context, not in the context of, oh, I wish I could, you know, I wish I had been a better person or something like that. I don't see any evidence for that. Even in about the closest you can get might be Luke 16, where the rich man, you know, asks that someone be sent to warn his brothers. I'm sort of wondering exactly what the motivations of that was, but there was no repentance expressed by that man. It wasn't, oh, Father Abraham, I am so deeply repentant that I treated Lazarus the way that I did. That's not there.
Yeah.
And it does make you wonder. But anyways, that's what I was referring to in that particular program, which was a very difficult program to do. That is not an enjoyable subject.
yeah.
But I gave it my best.
Well, I appreciate that. Just one quick question. Will you be around at Christmas time at the church?
I certainly would hope so. I try not to be gone around that time. In fact,
yeah.
I almost always preach whichever Sunday is closest to Christmas. So normally I'd be preaching at that point, yeah.
My mom is a Roman Catholic. I've been sharing Christ with her since the early 90s, since I was saved. And finally, it just seems in the last few years, she has really opened up to listening to anything I had to say. Mm. And I gave her your book on the Roman Catholic controversy. She really likes it, and she's been wanting to visit the church. I think she's like 20 minutes away. So I said, okay, we'll go there over Christmas.
Well, I'll look forward to seeing you then.
Yeah, well, I appreciate your work, and you've helped out me and a bunch of other brothers here in this area immensely, and you may not hear it, but we love you and love you as a brother and appreciate all your hard work you've done, and because it's benefiting many people,
all right.
Many brothers.
I appreciate that very much, Joe. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Dr. White.
All right, God bless.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
Boy, three encouraging phone calls there when you think about it. The YouTube channel providing information demonstrating that Islam is not the direction for someone in Estonia to go. King James only Gail Ripplinger's website designer. Oh, what does she know he's reformed? Oh my goodness. I forgot to ask him what the source of that was, but I have a feeling I know what it was. And then Joe there and the kind words you said there at the beginning. Very, very encouraging. Certainly helps me. Please pray for this weekend. I fly out tomorrow. Saturday night, I debate Christopher Ferrara on the sinlessness of Mary and the Immaculate Conception. Then on Preach Twice on Sunday and Monday evening, my debate with David Silverman, Vice President of American Atheists, on Is the New Testament Evil? And so lots of work to do this weekend. I'm going to be busy, busy, busy. Pray for health, safe travel, and the fact that I really need to get my presentations done. too much information, not enough time to get it all into a nice, clear format. So please pray that I will get all that done. And Lord willing, won't be here on Tuesday because I fly back on Tuesday. So the next Dividing Line will be a week from today. A week from today will be the next Dividing Line. I will be trying to live stream the debates, however. So I'll put that up on the blog, and you should be able to listen to the debates live. I'm taking the little computer. I got my Verizon wireless card upgraded back to the 5 gigs thing, so I'm not going to get hit with extra costs and stuff like that. So watch the blog. We'll see you then. God bless. I believe we're standing at the crossroads. Can't let this moment slip away. We must contend for the faith the fathers fought for. We need a new Reformation Day. It's a sign of the times. The truth is being trampled in a new age paradigm. Won't you lift up your voice? Are you tired of playing religion? It's time to make some noise.
The Dividing Line has been brought to you by Alpha and Omega Ministries. If you'd like to contact us, call us at 602-973-4602 or write us at P.O. Box 37106, Phoenix, Arizona 85069. You can also find us on the World Wide Web at aomin.org. That's aomin.org.
where you'll find a complete listing of James White's books, tapes, debates, and tracks. Join us again next Tuesday morning at 11 a.m. for The Dividing Line.